Hello and welcome to Great Lives. My guest today is the former leader of the Labour Party, Neil Kinnock, now Lord Kinnock of Bedwellty. No need, I think, for a potted biography. Lord Kinnock, there are some close connections between your own life and the life of the man you've chosen today. Tell us, who is your great life and why?
My great life is an Aaron Bevan, and indeed he remains my greatest hero. I'm from the same town, indeed the same ward in the same town as Bevan. But obviously, he was in his mid-40s when I was born. And so all connections end there, except for our shared politics. Because Bevan was born in the late 1890s. He was brought up in conditions of severe poverty. He was made to leave school at 13. He was a coal miner at 14. He was, in the most literal sense, self-educated and richly educated at that. And he was an adventurer of politics and a great constructor of politics. I was born in the lap of luxury, certainly working class.
In a house that he built, as it were.
I was born in a different house. I was born in rooms that my parents rented, and then we lived in a slum. And then we were translated out of that, indeed transformed out of that, by moving into a prefabricated bungalow, which was built under Bevan's post-war housing program, because people forget that he wasn't just the founder, the genius behind the National Health Service, but he was also simultaneously Minister of Housing. Can you imagine any government these days giving such huge responsibilities to an individual member of the cabinet?
Also with us is Dr. John Campbell, one of Nye Bevan's biographers. In your book, Dr. Campbell, you say that in his time, Bevan was the most colourful and controversial, most loved and most loathed political personality in Britain. Why loved? Why loathed?
I think he was loved because he was a most vivid, warm, inspiring, dazzling, and authentic personality, an impulsive personality, whom it was difficult not to respond to. But he was loathed, first, obviously, on the right by the Tories and the Tory press, because he was the most prominent left-wing sort of bogeyman of the time, as in later times we've had Tony Benn, Arthur Scargill. But more important, perhaps, he was loathed by large portions of the centre and right of the Labour Party, who saw him as a divisive, disruptive figure who resigned from the Attlee government, then resigned again from the Shadow Cabinet later, and was thought to be responsible for making Labour unelectable for 13 years.
Lord Kinnock, you met him when you were a young man.
I met Nye Bevan on a couple of occasions. First, he fulfilled the duty of the Member of Parliament for Ebbw Vale in that he gave out small amounts of money that came from the Urban District Council to each of the Sunday schools that paraded on Whitsun Monday through the town of Tredegar. And I was chosen when I was about eight, I think, to be the recipient of the envelope of money to support the work of the Sunday school. And Nye gave me the envelope and shook my hand. And given my upbringing and the attitude of my parents, the whole of my family, indeed, all the steelworkers and miners that I ever encountered, I was shaking hands with God. And that was apposite on Whitsun Monday. The other occasion, I was underage drinking in a pub in a village above the place where I was brought up, the village of Trevel, in the Quarryman's Arms, with some friends. And Bevan came off one of his walks with Jenny Lee and a couple of other people and walked through the back door. And such was the reverence in those days that I was terrified that he was going to report me to my parents, who he knew, and we scooted out of the front door. As I say, he was held almost in awe, but huge affection by the people in my family and those amongst whom I was brought up. I'll give you an illustration of that. I said to my grandfather once, "Which colliery did you work in, Gramp?" And he said, "Oh, I worked in the biggest colliery in the world." And I said, "Where was that?" He said, "Bedwellty, New Pits." And I said, "Well, I thought there was a small pit, Gramp." And he said, "Well, I thought it was too. But if all the people who say they worked with an Aaron Bevan did so, it was the biggest pit in the world."
Here he is, making, as it turned out, his last speech at the Labour Party conference at Blackpool in the autumn of 1959. I was 10. The Conservative Party had just won a second successive general election with a large majority, and Bevan's job was to rally his defeated comrades.
I have enough faith in my fellow creatures in Great Britain to believe that when they have got over the delirium of the television, when they realise that the new homes that they have been put into are mortgaged to the hilt, when they realise that the moneylender has been elevated to the highest position in the land, when they realise that the refinements to which they should look are not there, that it's a vulgar and a society of which no decent person could be proud, when the years go by and they see the challenge of modern society not being met by the Tories, when we realise that all the tides of history are flowing in our direction, that we are not beaten, that we represent the future, then when we say it and mean it, we shall lead our people to where they deserve to be led.
What I love about that piece of oratory, beyond the oratory itself, is the fearless candour, the courage to attack things that many of his audience might have thought they liked, like television, because Bevan thought they didn't ought to like them. Can you imagine any leading politician talking with, in a sense, such careless honesty, you know, Miliband in TV delirium gaffe or Cameron in Rage's City with moneylenders jibe? They don't have the courage these days, do they?
They don't have the courage, or maybe they've got more sensitivity to the way in which they would be treated if they did. Because, of course, Bevan was mercilessly attacked as a result of that. But what he was doing, as indeed Barbara Castle did in the same conference, was trying to rationalise the defeat by saying that it was attributable to the new affluence of the 1950s. I was brought up in a different spirit, which was enjoy affluence. Enjoy wall-to-wall carpeting. Love the home that is now comfortable and the fact that your father has always got a job and still be a socialist. And I think that Bevan, the bon viveur, the man with the hinterland, the master of literature and philosophy, the lover of poetry and music, on reflection, since he strove to get all those advantages for the people he represented, would come to a more sober view. Maybe he was, as you say, rallying the troops. But he was in the process, for once, and it was a rare occasion, letting himself down.
You know, Bevan was an old-fashioned neo-Marxist socialist. He really did believe that socialism would replace capitalism. And this was what he grew up with. This was what he believed. And he thought 1945 was the first instalment of that happening. He talked in that clip about the tides of history on our side. I think that the tides of history, he could see, were actually going away from him. The Macmillan government, the affluent society, working class people voting Tory, was not meant to happen.
How far, Neil Kinnock, can we really give Bevan the credit for the National Health Service? Was he just the right man at the right time enacting something for which there was a public demand?
He deserves huge gratitude and the accolade that it wouldn't have happened when it did, as it did, or continued its principles without Bevan's unique capability. Because this man was much more than anger. He was analytical. He was microscopic in examining an argument, stripping it away, and always illuminating what people thought was the strongest point in the alternative view, and then dismantling that, never going for the weakest, always going for the strongest. Now, the same capability was brought to bear in the construction and development of the National Health Service. But he realised, of course, that such was the extent of vested interests and some understandable reservations, especially in the medical professions, that compromise was essential. And therefore, what you saw was this ball of fire applying extensive pragmatism, and in his own words, stuffing their mouths with gold. And if that was the price to be paid for getting this, what was then, and for some years after, a model to the world, it was certainly worth doing. And this is what made Bevan special and great. It wasn't the fact only that he put poetry into politics, or that he was passion in action, but that he wanted to construct. And this is what distinguishes him from, for instance, the Bens and the Scargills, which John mentioned earlier, is the fact that he was a builder, he was a constructor. He wanted to get democratic power to use it to secure irreversible progress. And he did it in the case of the National Health Service and the post-war housing program.
Well, one thing that he and his civil servants completely underestimated was the cost of the service. The NHS was almost swamped by demand at the start, as he acknowledged at the end of its first year.
The first year has revealed what we all expected, a vast amount of silent good work, a great deal of relief, and a great deal of gratitude, but frictions at this point and that point, shortages. But I would have you realize, if I may, that most of the shortcomings which have been revealed by the British Health Service are not the result of the intrinsic defects of the service itself, but because of the overwhelming volume of need that the service itself has revealed.
You're listening to Great Lives with me, Matthew Paris. My guest is the former leader of the Labour Party, Lord Kinnock, and we're discussing his choice, the life of the founder of the NHS, Aniran Bevan. Bevan's biographer, Dr. John Campbell, is with us too. You heard his stammer there at the end of the speech. He conquered, didn't he, Lord Kinnock, a dreadful stammer as a young man?
He did, and there's speculation about where it actually came from. His brother, who I knew very well, said that when he was a child, he never had a stammer. He developed the stammer in what was then called elementary school, and his brother always believed it was the consequence of a dreadfully bullying teacher. But Billy Bevan, Aniran's brother, also felt that he was a natural left-hander, who, like all left-handers at that time, my own father-in-law included, was forced to write with his right hand. And in the process, he developed this stammer, which he only overcame by learning endless lengths of Shakespeare, the Bible, Wordsworth, Byron, Keats, all the great writers, and reciting them out loud to himself, usually as he walked over the hills around Tredegar. This isn't legend. This really did happen.
John Campbell, yes. In that very speech, he makes an assertion which is at least disputable, and it's a central assertion, and that is that the problems of overwhelming demand that the NHS met the moment it was set up were not intrinsic to the concept of the NHS, but were just because there was so much need. Is it fair to say that since then that assertion has been tested, that he didn't really acknowledge that there was going to be almost infinite potential demand?
Well, I don't think he did, but I don't think anybody else in the medical profession did either, which is more a criticism of them than of him. I think there was obviously an expectation that there was a lot of sort of a back need to be filled, but they felt that once that had been caught up, somehow medical science would remain static. It seems difficult to, it's one of those historical things, it's difficult to think yourself back into how they could imagine that medical technology would not create an ever-increasing demand and rising standards.
That didn't include Bevan, though, because Bevan's whole philosophy was based on the absolute certainty that nothing was static.
Mm. What about the other central tenet behind the service that he founded, which was monolithic, centralisation? Was he wrong?
He was right, because what he described very accurately in the system that was inherited was, in his term, a patchwork of local philanthropies. And the result of that was, of course, very uneven coverage. Mm. And you could not leave the continuation of the health service, let alone a national health service, which is why he put great emphasis on the term, to such an arrangement.
Yes, I mean, I think it was probably the right decision at the time to cut through the sort of the patchwork and create the national system. It has had the result of producing a huge centralized
bureaucracy.
In a sense, as John Campbell himself has written, ever since the 60s, Labour leaders have sought to wrap themselves in the mantle of Nye. But the party itself now finds itself in the position of moving away from some of those rather rigid and centralised solutions, away from exactly the thing that Nye was doing.
We moved away from rigid centralised solutions a long time ago. Yes. I'm not even sure that we ever embraced them. Given the times of the 1940s, I've always insisted, and I think history supports me, that the nationalisation that was undertaken extensively in the 1940s by that Labour government was much more Red Cross than Red Flag. It owed very little, if anything, to ideology and everything to emergency, the need for survival in industries that had been outrageously neglected and underinvested for a generation before.
And you'd say then that Nye Bevan addressed the problems of his day in the way that they needed to be addressed in his day, but that he was a man of such a mind that were he alive today, he would have very different solutions.
Absolutely, because he continually asserted that the duty of the democratic representative, and particularly of the democratic socialist, is to address the practical condition in which the people being represented live now, and to seek to design credibly for their future. Now, for me, that's why I could say without any reservation when the term New Labour was invented, that's fine with me. If it ain't new, it ain't Labour.
Now, I agree entirely that Bevan was, above all, a democratic socialist. I mean, he had no truck with any sort of non-parliamentary route because he had a clear optimistic belief that once the working class saw its best road clearly, it would vote for the Labour Party and the Labour Party would introduce socialism. He thought socialism would come democratically. But I do think that he had a more ideological, a more Marxist view of the idea of replacing a capitalist form of organisation with a socialist form of organisation, that just diluting it to welfare capitalism was a betrayal of what it was all about. And I do think, you said that Labour leaders had wrapped around themselves in the mantle of Nye. I do think they have, to some extent, over the last two generations, invoked the name of Nye for a very diluted form of what he would not have recognised as socialism.
Yes, there have been all kinds of uses and abuses of the name of Nye Bevan. And when people use the term, as Nye said, it is too often, not always, but too often, the lead up to a particular treachery. There's no doubt at all about that. He did, however, say, our object is not to topple any class, but to elevate all classes. Mm. And that wasn't a catchphrase or what we'd call a soundbite these days. He tried to live by that. For instance, the friendships he had and his hinterland of literature and culture and self-indulgence. He liked champagne, he preferred red wine, but nevertheless he was called the Bollinger Bolshevik. He said on one occasion, people ask me what I want for my people, and he said, and I tell them, I want the best. Mm. And they ask me, Mr. Bevan, how much do you want? And I tell them, all of it, all of the best. Yeah.
And he was going to get it first, in a sense, as representative of his class.
Because he lived quite well, didn't he?
Lived very well. He enjoyed the good things of life. The other Welsh mining MPs in the House of Commons, his friends from Lord Beaverbrook downwards, were not his fellow Welsh miners at all. So he did live a life very much apart, and he had a farm in the Chilterns. And,
well, he didn't have a farm. He had a farmhouse, which was renovated.
Okay. But he was a long way.
Oh, he was.
He was a long way from Overbury.
He never made any kind of pretense about that. Mm. In Tredegar, when I was being brought up, there were some critics, and his enemies always tried to deploy that envy, that sense that he was abusing the opportunities that he had. I always tried to deploy that against him.
While we're on the personal side of his life, there are two very close and extraordinary relationships that I'd like to ask you about Lord Kinnock. The first is his marriage to fellow socialist Jenny Lee. This was a very strong marriage, if not an entirely conventional one, wasn't it?
It was very unconventional marriage in many ways, and it came about because Jenny's family and supporters in the coalfields of Ayrshire And Nye's family and supporters in the coalfield of South Wales didn't like the idea of them living in sin. And so they got married simply to please their families. Mm. But of course, it was ironclad. It didn't prevent either of them straying. And that isn't terribly well documented, but I think it was pretty widely known. But their relationship with each other was deep, loving, inspirational, and adventurous, as well as being very strongly political.
The second relationship was a friendship with the black American singer Paul Robeson.
Yeah.
Neil Kinnock, I believe you saw Robeson when he visited Tredegar. How did that come about, and how did the friendship come about?
The friendship came about originally because in the 1930s, when Robeson was the target of a great deal of official antagonism in the United States of America, because he was a radical, because he was a left-winger, and, of course, an immensely attractive and beautiful person and performer. Mm. Bevan communicated with him and declared his solidarity. And eventually, some years later, Robeson came to the United Kingdom and sung in charity concerts to raise money for children on the coalfield. And their friendship then developed into a very strong mutual relationship. And then back then in the 1950s, after Bevan had been a distinguished minister and was the firebrand and the whole of history was laid out, Robeson, of course, was the particular object of the anti-communist witch hunts led by Joe McCarthy, Senator McCarthy, and his passport was withdrawn. And so he was communicated with by telephone and by radio, and he performed a concert for the South Wales Miners again in a radio broadcast, which was then recorded and sent over and played everywhere throughout South Wales. And then by 1958, when the Nationalist Eisteddfod was held in Ebbw Vale in Bevan's constituency, Robeson came to Ebbw Vale to sing. And he also sang in the Workman's Hall in Tredegar, in my hometown. And so I twice heard Paul Robeson singing. And it is, for anybody who's ever heard it, he was a sort of bass Pavarotti and a man of profound beliefs.
As I read your book, John Campbell, and as I've listened to you throughout your political career, Neil Kinnock, I've been conscious in both of what is to an Englishman a sort of disjunction, warmth, passion in the most generous sense, humour, humanity, eloquence so poetic as to enlarge and elevate the imagination of your audience. And then amid all this big-heartedness, just occasionally a switch is thrown and there come these sudden acid flashes of bitterness, of anger, partisan, ungenerous, sometimes even sour sounding. You put it down to righteous anger, if you like, but it sort of curdles the milk. And it's one of the reasons, perhaps, why the English always found you a little confusing. Is it a Welsh thing, do you think?
I don't know if it's a Welsh thing. I think it's a fighter's thing.
Yeah.
I think that if we use the analogy of a duel or a boxing match, that provided that your opponent is not breaking the rules and is aiming at your head and your torso and doesn't try to get you below the belt, you will fight with cool passion as a gent should.
Mm.
But if he headbutts you or kidney punches you or tries to get you below the belt, he will get everything he deserves, which will generally mean an elbow in his eye, which hurts a lot. And that was Bevan. He was a fighter. And like all good fighters, he had to keep his inner temper. But occasionally, to use your word, he would flash with rage.
Mm. You did the same thing with that, I think, extraordinarily potent remark about, you know, too bad they had to spill their guts at Goose Green to prove that the lady...
Same kind of thing, I suppose.
Exactly the same kind of thing, which is almost too potent.
But authentic.
Yeah.
I mean, you actually... There's some kind of safety valve that most of the time, and certainly this applies to Bevan, and I would never put myself in anything like his category as an orator, but there is a safety valve that means that you will respond authentically into something that outrages. Mm. But never make that a continual hymn of hatred. Mm. Your only stock in trade.
As we come to the end of our discussion, John Campbell, I'd like to quote something you wrote in your biography, tellingly titled Nye Bevan and the Mirage of British Socialism. You concluded that Bevan's life, the immense achievement of the NHS notwithstanding, was essentially a failure because his great gifts were all his life enthralled to an erroneous dogma, with the result that he utterly misread what he most passionately believed himself to understand, the trend of history. Listening to Neil Kinnock, do you still think that's fair?
I'm afraid I think I do, yes. I think he had a wonderful, noble vision and a confidence that it would work out an inevitability, that this was the way that social development was evolving, and he was confident that this was the way it would go. It may be in the long run, in 100 years' time, he'll be right, but in his own lifetime and for half a century since, the tide of history has been going in very much the opposite way. He would not have... Nobody did expect Thatcherism. You know, he was appalled enough by Macmillanism. It did seem that if anybody could have converted, persuaded the British people to vote for socialism, it would have been Nye. Nye was the most wonderful exponent of it. But the tide was going the other way in the last decade of his life. So I think, as I say, notwithstanding the achievement of the health service, but he didn't think the NHS on its own was socialism. He was looking forward to socialism replacing capitalism, and it hasn't happened.
Last word, Neil Kinnock.
The final word I'd use to define the great life of an Iron Bevan come from Henry Fairley, a critic, writing of all places in the Daily Mail just days after Bevan died. The overwhelming impression that remains is of a man of size, a man whose intellect was capacious, lively, and illuminating, a man whose emotions were strong and human, a man who believed greatly in his country and believed also, which is rare in these days, in the power of ideas, a man who strove to retain the predominance of politics over economics or mass psychology. For this, in the end, is what we owe to politicians like him. A democracy cannot survive healthily without the example of individual leaders who dare all as individuals and leave, long after their failures are forgotten, the imprint of a great human being.
You've been listening to Great Lives. My thanks to my guest, Lord Kinnock of Bedwellty, who chose Nye Bevan, and to our expert witness, Bevan's biographer, John Campbell. Goodbye.